author, David S., from Paso Robles, California.
We have a Christmas tree ornament for the front door. This is cool.
I love saving a buck.
Hi, everybody. I'm David, an alcoholic. And I'm from Paso Robles, California. And my home group is the ABC group. It's at 514 14th Street. It's always easy to remember. And we welcome any and all of you. Not at the same time. Okay? It's amazing how we ended up in Paso Robles. I was from San Jose. I had moved there in 1972 from a state hospital, and we'll get into that. But we've just been blessed, and I really mean that. And it's been Alcoholics Anonymous. It's been the power of the people in the book. I met a man from here, probably in the mid-70s. He always used his first and last name, Bud Tollefson. He made it. He died at 51 years sober. I remember meeting him because he had white patent leather shoes on. And I didn't run the other way. And I basically ran into his arms. His phone number was 408-984-1558. And I remember that number because I used to go to jail frequently and I would call him. He was my one phone call. And I only called him once. And I said, "Bud, I'm in jail again." It was 2 a.m. He goes, "Wow, too bad." And I said, "Well, yeah." I said, "I need someone to bail me out." And he said, "Good luck," and hung up. I have feelings. It was very hurtful. I would really like to thank David and Patty and Mom. I love you. With a love I didn't know I could love with. And I love all of you. And I used to hear people say that from podiums and meetings, and it just made me want to puke. You know? I love all of you. And a very special thanks to one of my good friends, David, who I've met here, who has taken care of Deb and I the last 3 days in a way that no one deserves to be taken care of. And you can take that any way you want. It's the first time you haven't had a comeback. Yet. Well, you know, I asked for a picture last night with the beautiful voice and David and myself. And the reason I did that was because the host, MC, the voice. Let's stick with the voice. Probably 16 years ago at this convention, got up on a Friday night, it was before any of the speakers, and said these words, and I can quote them. I want to welcome you all here. You're going to hear a lot of good speakers this weekend. But please, people. And he said, please, three times. And I knew he was going to say, please, three times before he said it. He said, please, 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 don't keep secrets. They will kill you. So if you hear nothing else this weekend, please hear that. And I felt just like a... because I had just created my secret about maybe 6 months, maybe a year earlier. And my secret was, which I hung on to for about 14 years or 13 years in this program, was that one night I couldn't sleep. And so I thought, wow, phenobarbital, that's non-habit forming. Here we go. And they were my dogs. Also known as doggy downers. Well, the dog was dead. She didn't need them. Okay? She wasn't going to do anything with them, and I couldn't sleep, so I took one. And I slept wonderfully that night. I really did. The next night, I couldn't sleep again. I waited 2 or 3 minutes. So I took another one. And thus started my secret. That's why in my home group, I always like to start off with saying, I'm David, I'm an alcoholic, and I had another blessed day because I woke up without any secrets. I have no secrets. I know a new joy and a new happiness, new freedom. Because I have no secrets. It started off like a little grain of sand in a backpack. And it moved into a pebble and then a rock and then a boulder. And then pretty soon, after about 10 or 12 years, I felt like I had a couple bowling balls on my back. Just right. I knew how to deal with it because I knew how to deal with pain. And the pain of that secret almost killed me. It was 4 years ago, last December 23rd. I had had leg surgery 4 times at Stanford. And I was given pain meds, and we all know that story. And then I told the doc, I can't sleep at night. He says, well, here, take these. And it was a drug called Ambien. And I started taking them. And I started blacking out. And there were many warnings. The first one was a jar of orange marmalade. I had dropped it, thinking I was still in bed. I was out in the hallway, and it crashed and broke right between my feet. That's what woke me up. And I went, wow. There's another secret. I'm not telling anybody about that. Next time was in the middle of a Safeway or Lucky supermarket at 1:30 in the morning. I'm going through the supermarket on crutches with a leg cast shopping. How the hell do you shop when you got a crutch under each arm and a leg cast on? I don't know. And I woke up to my big friend Jeff, who worked there, yelling, David, David. And he was coming up behind me with one of those electric carts. And he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm shopping. Truth is, I thought I was home in bed. Cunning, baffling, powerful. So people, if you hear nothing else this weekend,
Please, please, please hear this. Don't keep secrets. They will kill you. And possibly someone with you. You never know. I didn't know I was going to get that out of the way so early. It was kind of my closing thing, you know. It's like, damn it. Now what do I say? You've all heard, you know, the three things we always share at meetings, especially from a podium like this, is the things we think we should say, the things we actually say, and the things we wish we had have said. And those will come, believe me. I know me that well. I was born in Berkeley, California. Go Bears. And I think that right there qualifies me for being up here. I do. But, you know, it's quite something. And I guess we moved down to a little town in Southern California called Bellflower. And I lived there for about 4 years, I'm told. And the only thing I really remember about Bellflower is throwing a stack of hardcover books through my sister's bedroom window at the age of probably 3. I was born pissed off. I was born without a coper. I couldn't cope, you know. And it never got any better. In 1952, we moved up to Northern California, little town of Marysville. Recently, 10 years ago, I was up there and Deb and I were visiting my mom. And I thought, wow, I think I'll go drive by the Gaslighter. That's a bar. I didn't want my wife at that time knowing how much I was drinking, so I would tell her every night, I'm going to take a walk. And I'd walk over to the Gaslighter, and there was always other people in there. I'm about 22 years old, and I was probably 50 years younger than anybody else in there, you know. And I would have my 3 double shots or whatever I was doing, and then I'd go on home. So I decided to drive by the Gaslighter. I went by the Gaslighter, and I looked up, and it was the Alano Club of Marysville. They turned my bar into an Alano Club. And I ended up going to a meeting there that night. Because I wanted to be sure I had the right address. And I did.
Oh, you must have used to drink here.
Yeah, I'm told I did. You know. Marysville was quite the community. I was in advanced classes up through the 5th grade. You know, A's and B's. And then in the 6th grade, they dropped me down a level. And all my friends just kind of went away. My dad was a preacher. He had one of the largest churches in Northern California. And that was a problem for me because all my friends' dads had real jobs. That's just how I thought back then. I mean, Jimmy's dad was police sergeant. Leon's dad wore faded blue jeans and plaid shirts and climbed telephone poles. You know, Steve's dad worked with Division of Highways back when they used to work. I see where this is going. There's going to be some tense steps after this. So I'll just do one big one for all of you. And my dad was a preacher. And all he did for a living, and back then, you were mostly who you were, at least my impression was, by what your dad did. You know. And I was ashamed. I was embarrassed. Especially because my mom was redheaded Betty Nell from Texas, and she was a rager. She was always convinced that she was an alcoholic because of her parents, my grandparents. They pretty well grew up in bars and stayed there in El Paso. And she was convinced she was alcoholic, so she should never, ever take a drink. And she never did. Oh, how I wish she would have. You know, really. And she would pound on my dad, verbally, physically, emotionally, a lot. And I still have the vision of my dad like this, because he couldn't take a blow to the face because he was also a marriage counselor. And I thought, man, if this is what God does in a man's life, I think I'll go the other way. So I did. I went out and joined a bicycle gang. And we called ourselves the Little Horribles. And we had bicycles with handlebars way up here. And we just ride around the town of Marysville, terrorizing it. And if you were going to be a little horrible, you had to get a tattoo on your leg in the boys' bathroom at recess. And I got my tattoo. Of course, when I was 18, I graduated to county jails, and I decided one day in the cell block I didn't want a tattoo, so I burned it out with a coat hanger. Now I've got a scar that I'm identified with. It's like, you just can't get away sometimes. Marysville was quite the community. I always wanted to belong. I just wanted to fit in somewhere. I heard this said one time, and I related to it. It was in one of these rooms. The speaker said that prior to Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt like I was a blind man in a dark room looking for a black cat that wasn't there. And when I heard that said, I went, you know, I might have a shot at this. I just might. I got out of the Little Horribles, and Mom bought me a horse. And I was told, don't buy that horse. That horse is crazy. It will kill you. Now I really wanted that horse. I did. I did. His name was Spook. That should have been a clue right there. Oh, good. I'm glad you guys switched. You're both a blessing, you know, to all of us. My wife's shaking her head with a hand in it. She's praying for me again. I know it. In the name of Jesus. Continue to heal this man. How you say Jesus? Oh, my goodness. And I really meant that from my heart. I wanted to know how. So I bought a horse and I joined Silver Spurs. Again, just because I wanted to fit in somewhere. And I went to gymkhanas and rodeos and trail rides where we'd take our horses up in the mountains, the Sierras, and ride horses. And then shortly after that, or a few years later, I guess, we moved to Vallejo. And I traded in my horse, David. Oh, Vallejo. We survived Vallejo, man. He got shot, I got stabbed. I mean, you know, that's enough of the Vallejo story right there, you know. We moved to Vallejo and I traded the horse for a motorcycle. And a few years later, I joined a gang. because that's what I needed to do. I just wanted to fit in. So I joined a gang, and we did a lot of crazy stuff. We did security. Would you take his phone, honey, please? Group level, dude. I love you, man. You know that. Ain't nothing you can do about it. And you know, it just ended up that I guess I was 17 years old. I was downtown Vallejo, one block off Georgia Street. I don't think we had the alleys named back then. And I was in this little piss-in-the-sink house, you know, what couldn't even call it a house, you know, probably a tough shed. You know, I don't know what it was, but I know what happened. One of my buddies said, put your arm out, man, try this. Okay. There's another one. There's another. I'm going to chase that for the next 20 years. I ended up in Vallejo for a long time. I lived a lot of those years in institutions. Deb and I were going up to Fairfield almost 20 years ago. This is my normal wife when it comes to drinking. For those of you that can't see in the back, I'm going to share a story. 2 days ago, okay, 3 days ago, I got to ride in the front seat of his limousine, you know, and we were having fun. We're out cruising, and we pulled in to get some fuel up North Shore, South Shore, East Shore, West Shore. I don't know shores here. I can't even say anything more than Malachi, and I think that's the Bible. Huh. Y'all just keep laughing. I don't care. I'm burning up minutes. I'm serious. The taper guy came up to me before the meeting and he said, I just want to know how long you're going to talk. What's your normal time? And I said, well, probably about 4.5 hours. And he goes, well, I have only 80 minutes of room on a CD. And I said, I'll use about half of that. Because I know it'll get back to my sponsor that I talked too long. And that ain't going to happen, you know. You know what's nice is when I can't remember where I was talking. Oh, yeah. You thought you got off the hook, huh? No. We pulled in for fuel, and there's this little cutie pie getting some fuel in her car. And, of course, one of the Davids in the car, not me, the other one, started talking to her. And she was really a cutie. And so he's got his car door open, and I just wanted to lean over and simply say, if he asks for your phone number, he doesn't come with warning labels. Okay, you might not want to get, I didn't even get half of that out, and here comes the car door, slam. I said, dude, I was just trying to be your wingman here. She, you know, I never got back in the front seat for the next 2 days, ever. My wife and David, I wanted to talk to my wife yesterday. I couldn't get in to the conversation. I'm like up on the bucket seats, and I had to call her on her cell phone from the back seat. Seriously, you can't make this stuff up. Right, Opie? You can't make it up. And then David called me back on his car phone. And I answered, and I said, hello, and he hung up on me. Yes, it did. So, moving to Vallejo, Deb and I had just met, maybe a week or two, three. Okay, she says three is okay. It's my Al-Anon wife. She gives me the Al-Anon salute oh so often. She really does. And I mean that with all respect to the Al-Anons in the room. I really do. And we're driving. I had been asked to go up to Fairfield, Solano County, Fairfield, on North Texas Street to speak at a something. And we're driving up North Texas Street, and I tell her, and she's like this beautiful person that doesn't drink, she doesn't smoke, you know, she's just like a square. I had tried every alcoholic woman in the room. That wasn't working. I mean, been married a couple times, divorced, you know, a lot of pain and recovery sometimes, especially when you don't take your own inventory. We're going up North Texas Street, and I said, oh, I used to live right there. And she goes, oh, what's that? I said, that's juvenile hall. She goes, oh. And then I got about four blocks further, and I go, oh, and I used to live right there. And she goes, well, what's that? I said, that's the county jail. I graduated from juvenile hall, and I went to the county jail. Doing time was not a problem for me. After years of doing time. And we've been together ever since. She heard my story that day. She wanted to do a strange thing for me that I thought was strange anyway. We're out in the parking lot, and she said, well, you're going to go in to talk to all those people. How about if I pray over you first? And I just went, wow, okay, I got this. We came to a convention a couple of years before the one I told you about, and we were practicing celibacy before marriage. We needed to try something different than we had done in the past. I don't recommend bringing your wife to Hawaii while you're practicing celibacy. Wow. But we did it. We went to Cancun and we stayed celibate. We decided that we needed to try something different. And this whole period of time, boy, you guys are really getting in here, aren't you? This whole period of time, I didn't get it. I didn't get it. Why are we doing this way? Wow. And after we had been married about 6 months, I looked over at her one day and I said, I get it. And what I got was this. How a man and woman can grow together without sex. How'd you do sex? Oh, must be good. I'm sorry. Wow. You know, the only sad part of this is you're getting more laughter than I am, okay? Maybe you should just come on up here. You can do your sign language, and we will guess what you're saying. Oh. I love laughter. I do. And if I'm up here trying to get you to laugh today, it ain't going to work. If I come up here and just be me, people laugh at the strangest things I share. I don't get it. 1972. We're just going to move on into recovery. 1972, I was living in the Mendocino State Hospital for about the third time. I had been in Napa State Hospital four or five times on commitments because I was crazy. I was 147 pounds. I was using that stuff that you don't have to eat on for 10 to 15 days at a time. I had had hepatitis twice because I wasn't, you know, doing things I should have done sanitarily. And I was up in Mendocino, and after about 6 months of being back up there, they gave me a privilege card. And that meant I could go out on the grounds of the hospital. I see a lot of heads nodding right now. Yeah. And I met an interesting woman. She was very beautiful. She was a doctor's wife. Her husband practiced medicine in San Jose. And she was up there on a barbiturate addiction. And we just met. And one day we were out walking on these grassy knolls, and we just lied on our backs and looked up into this pine tree, and up in the very top of that pine tree were two pine cones like this, growing side by side, and we both had the same thought at the same time. That must be a sign. We belong together. So she asked me that day or a week later, I don't know, but she said, have you ever been to San Jose? And I said, no, I haven't. I've always been in Vallejo, East Bay. And she goes, oh, well, you know, maybe when you get out, you could come down and see me. A little while later, she came to San Jose. She brought me a 65 Mustang. She came to Vallejo, picked me up in a 65 Mustang that she had bought for me. Got me an apartment in San Jose on College Drive. The first thing I think I did when I moved in there was kick three fence boards out, because why should you have to walk all the way around the block to the liquor store? You can just right through the boards. And that's what I did. That's what I did. I came home one day, and my friend Elsie was out in the parking lot. Elsie and I went to clinics with metal boxes with locks on them, you know, quite a bit. And her husband, Jim, went with us. And I came home one day, and she was out in the parking lot crying. And I said, Elsie, why are you crying? And she looked at me, and she said, Jim had just killed some guy over under the carport with a hammer. And they came, and they took him away. And I went, oh, dude. That's really sad. And she turned around and started walking toward her apartment, and then she turned around and said these words. She said, David, you're every bit as sick as Jim. Why don't you try to get some help while you still can? And I did. I ended up in a place called Chrysalis. My friend Danny T was out there and a few other nuts. And I checked in, and the only literature we had was a 24-hour day book, non-approved AA literature. I don't care. If it helps me, I don't care. And I went to my first meeting. I went to my first meeting at the Red Cross building in Los Gatos on Highway 9 on a Sunday morning, because they had told me, get in the van, you're going to a meeting. Well, I wanted the three hots and a cot they were giving me, so I got in the van, and I went to my first ever meeting. I was 24 years old. I walked into that room. Man, I was looking young, really young. And some of the old-timers back then thought, if you walked into the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous and you still had a wristwatch on, you weren't ready for this program. It's true. I'd think, man, he could have traded that for a drink. I didn't have a wristwatch on. I didn't have anything on or in side. And, you know, by that time, I had had a lot of difficulty with staying alive. I had had two documented DOAs at Vallejo General Hospital. I had had hepatitis twice. I had had a punctured lung and a severed main artery in my chest from a knife fight. I was 100 yards from Yuba General Hospital. They told me 200 yards, I would have died. I'd had a lot of trouble. I'd been married a couple times. And after the meeting, some old fart came up to me and he said, "It's nice to see you young people in here. You won't have to go through what the rest of us did." And I'm thinking, man, that's pretty rough. I'd love to tell you I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous and everything's been perfect and wonderful ever since. That's not the case. That's not the case at all. I ended up going back to prison. I'm in Terminal Island in Long Beach, walking around in khakis, getting the crease just right for visiting. I told you I could iron, honey. And one day they announced that there was going to be a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous in the cafeteria. So I looked around the yard and none of the fellas were watching. And when they weren't, I snuck off into that meeting. Because I had an image to live down to. I walked into the meeting. None of the fellas were there, but a guy I knew was. And his name was Johnny Harris. And he was there with his wife, Dottie. And I remember Dottie's eyes. She had the most beautiful eyes ever. She had a ski coat on with some kind of dead rabbit wrapped around her neck or something. She was just beautiful. And Johnny looked at me and he said, "You're reading the fifth chapter." And I looked around the room and none of the fellas were there. It was a cafeteria at least this big. And I got up on the podium and I started reading. Rarely have we seen a person fail as thoroughly follow their path. And gone and on. I got right around the steps and I looked up and there were my two cellmates in the back of the room leaning on their mops, staring at me in disbelief. It's like, what is he doing up there? There's no hustle in here. There's no free donuts. There's no free Zuzus and Wham Whams. There's no cigarettes. Because they used to pass out cigarettes and donuts in some of the H&I meetings. And a little piece of me died instantly at that podium. And a new piece of me began to live for the very first time in my life. 2 weeks later, I'm walking across the yard every day, dodging seagull poop, you know, in the fog some mornings. And I had school books under my arm. And I got a GED. I remember Wilson Riles had signed it. Superintendent of Schools for California. I want to back up a little. I want to tell you why I'm really standing here today. And that is because it happened in the Solano Hotel in Vallejo. Are you old enough to remember the Solano Hotel? Oh, you're old. It was September 5th, 1972. The bikers I was riding with didn't really want me around a whole lot because I had gone crazy. So, Well, you never know. It could be me over here next year. I mean it. I got stuffed. I just wouldn't know how to not talk. September 5th, 1972, I'm up on the third floor of this hotel. I was paying a hot $16 a week to be in it. And I decided I didn't want to be here anymore. I had made that decision before, but I think there was always a last-minute phone call or something. This time there wasn't, and I knew how to do it. It was too much of this substance in a bag to put in a rig, so I put it in a water glass and I mixed it up and I drank it and I knew I was going to die. There was enough in that glass to kill an elephant. And I remember kind of the room going dark a little bit. And I don't know what I really remember. I don't remember a damn thing really, but I do remember this. I remember shortly after that there was a knock at my door And it was an old man that I had met in the lobby a couple days before, and I was very antisocial. I had worked long and hard for this badass look to keep you away so you wouldn't find out how scared I was. And there was a knock at the door, and it was him. And he looked at me, and he said, "My God, what have you done?" I don't know what I said, but I know what he said. He said, "Wait here. I will get you something." It's not like I had a choice of waiting there or not. I was dying. I couldn't even get up out of this big chair with all the cigarette burns in it. You know, I couldn't get up. And shortly after that, very shortly after that, there was another knock at the door. And when they opened it, because I couldn't get up by then, there was a young boy and a young girl standing in that doorway. They were probably 14 or 15, maybe 16 years old at the oldest. And they looked at me and they smiled. And they had love in their eyes. I didn't know it was love at that time. I didn't know what love was at that time. But they asked if they could come in and pray with me. Right away I'm going, "Oh man, there's that God thing again." I didn't really have much love or need for that God. And I ended up praying with that boy and that girl that day in that room. And I was instantly as clean and sober as I am standing here right now. That's what it took from the power of God, who I choose to call Jesus Christ, for me. No offense to any Jews or Muslims. That's what it took for me to wake up to the power. Shortly after that, I was walking 13 to 16 blocks with him over to Tennessee Street near Amador. And shortly after that, I went up to the town of Lolita, which is by Eureka, California, on the coast to the Lighthouse Ranch. During this time, I had had a son born, 1970 or 71. They named him David. That's kind of backing up a little bit, but I don't want to leave him out. And that was my second child by a different mother. My first child, my daughter Kim, Kimmy, because she's not here. I can say Kimmy. And she doesn't like oldest child. She likes firstborn, you know. I got to meet her when she was 15. And then David, the day he was born, I was in the back room. It was a screened-in porch that we had a bed in, back up in Marysville, 100 yards from Yuba General Hospital, thank God. I got up and I walked out front, and on the front lawn was my little brother-in-law, Walter. He was probably 8 or 9 years old. And he was just standing on the front grass like this, looking at the front door. And I opened the door. I went, "Walter, what are you doing standing out there?" He said, "Judy went to the hospital and I had to have the baby. Can I go home now?" He was told to stand there until they couldn't wake me up to take her to the hospital. And she had my son. So immediately I got in my 37 Dodge truck, stepped aside, went over the bridge into Yuba City and got to see the baby through the glass. And there wasn't a whole lot of graciousness going on by any of my wife's family. I don't understand that. Yeah, I do. And she said, "Could you please be here in a day or two to pick me up and David and take us home?" I said, absolutely. I'll be here. I forgot. I was loaded. The front door of the duplex we were in opened, and there was Judy standing with this little bundle in her arms, and I'm not alone on the couch. I lived with that guilt for many, many years. I no longer live with that guilt, but I live with that memory, because that kind of stuff is what the disease will do to people like me. It has no boundaries on the takedown. I got to meet David when he was 20. I hadn't seen him since he was 2. We would go to flea markets, fairs, anywhere, and I was sober. And I'd see these little blonde-haired, blue-eyed boys running around in the fair or somewhere, and I'd think, well, maybe that's him, maybe that's him, maybe that's him. In Christmas of 1990, I got a phone call one day, and he said, is this David Searles? Can I use my last name? I better be able to, because I just did. And I don't care. I want you to be able to find me, you know? And I said, yeah. And he says, the David Searles that used to live in Vallejo. And I said, yeah. He says, was your dad a preacher? And I went, Scoots? And I heard the phone go, oh my God, no one's called me that in years. And I picked him up at the airport about 3 or 4 days, maybe a week later. It was December 20th. 20-some years ago. And some of my buddies in the program wanted to go to SFO, San Francisco Airport, with me. And I just went, no, you know, this is something I need to do by myself. And I knew it was him when he got off the plane. You know. I needed to mention that. I need to remember things. I need to keep my feelings and my words connected. It would be real easy for me to get up and just kind of hit the mental play button. Here I am. How do you like me now? No. 1974, I was in a place called Pathway. I had been released to it out of the Santa Clara County Jail. And it was on South 11th Street in San Jose. It was one of the recovery houses. I see you back there. Represent, man. one of the few recovery houses in San Jose that would let me in anymore. Because I was drinking in stairwells and parking garages down by the university. Sleeping and drinking in stairwells. And I went into this place called Pathway, and the house director told me one day, he says, you know, there's a guy coming in tomorrow morning, and he's going to be speaking in the basement at 9 o'clock, and you better have your ass down there. And I went, okay. So I walked down the steps into the basement, and I sat down, and this guy walks in, and he's probably one of the most butt-ugly people I've ever seen in my life. The guy is just... He's got like this star tattooed on his cheekbone. This was 45 years ago or so. I got tattoos when tattoos weren't very common. I got an ear pierced when in a recovery house, chrysalis, with a potato, a needle, and an ice cube. I never found out what the ice cube was for, but I still have the earring. Well, not the same one. And, this guy walked in and he went and got up to a podium they had down there and started to talk. And all of a sudden I caught my head going like this, when he always felt like he was apart from. I always felt like I was apart from. I just did a time check and that threw me off. And his name was George. and he became my sponsor. He was up there sharing, and he said, you know, I've had a lot of problems with alcohol. And he said, but I want to tell you something. I lived 14 years on death row in Texas, and I got out on a technicality. And today I'm a federal parole officer for the government. So after the meeting, I said, George, will you be my sponsor? And he looked at me and he said, I don't know everything a sponsor is supposed to be, but I know what a friend is. I'll be your friend. And he said, never forget this. Some days I pitch, some days I catch. It's a two-way street. And he always called me David because he was from Texas. I was David, David. And also, yeah, but, you know. Because everything he told me, I'd go, yeah, but you don't understand. And he used to come pick me up for meetings when I got out of Pathway. I got a little room by the college there. He used to come pick me up for meetings, and I'd have to run alongside his car. He'd never stop it all the way, and I'm running alongside, and I'd jump in, and I'd go, why do you keep doing this, George? And go, I'm just testing your willingness, Bubba. You know? It's very hurtful. One day he came over. Oh, you came in at the perfect time. This is going to be fun. You won't look at me, will you? What timing was that? Because here it comes. One day he came over with a Safeway shopping bag. And I'm thinking, oh, man, Huevos Rancheros, something, man. George is going to burn. Because he used to be a cook in prison. And probably not when he was on death row. I doubt as though they let him have knives and utensils. But anyway, it's nice to be able to catch that stuff. Keep coming back. And he set it down on this table. And I walked over and I looked in it, and there was nothing but Penthouse and Playboy magazines in that bag. And I said, George, what is that? What's that about? And he goes, that's about the only relationship you're going to have for the next year, Bubba. I still remember Miss February 78. There it is. You know why I'm doing this? Because if anybody ever listens to my CD, they're going to just think, boy, that guy's a lot funnier than he sounds. Thank you. It was suggested I try saying one word four times, real fast, and look over at you, but I'm not going to do that. Because Johnny, oh, I just got the Al-Anon wave, too. Johnny Harris told me this. When I came into the program, you can tone it down a little now. I got it, okay? Okay. Johnny told me that, you know, I still thought mother was two words, and I was like, you know, and all that. And he told me that cussing was a crutch for conversational cripples. And while we're talking about that, I'm going to talk about cell phones, because in my home group, there's people in the room, and occasionally it's been me, okay? I want to keep that in there. But that text during a meeting, that's... And I'm okay with that until I see a newcomer looking over at that person texting. And then a few minutes later, the newcomer has his phone out and he's texting. We carry messages in these rooms many different ways. We really do. I just wanted to say that. I am so grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous and its people. 1976, I had a daughter born. 1979, I got a phone call one night from Santa Cruz, right over the Santa Cruz Mountains. How much time do I have left? 3 hours and what? Yeah. No. Seriously, I forgot what time we end. Me? More? Huh. Okay. I wasn't sure. Yeah, I'm just afraid if I talk too long, it's going to get back to my sponsor, Bob, in San Jose. That's, you know, he just celebrated 52 years in this program, and I'm grateful for that. I am. I got a phone call one night. Man, I love it when I get back there on my own. See, right here, there's a book. There's really not much in it, but I've been watching the other speakers look down a lot, and I'm thinking, holy crap, are they using notes up there? Because they keep doing this. And no, it's just the book with the meeting thing you do in it and all that. And I haven't read anything yet, but it's nice to look down occasionally when I can't look you in the eye for a minute. So it was my daughter's mother. My daughter was 3 years old, blonde hair, blue-eyed kid. And she says, I hear you're clean and sober again. I said, yep. Got about a year again. And she said, well, I'm not. You need to come get this kid. She said she shouldn't be left alone at night while I'm out on the streets at 3 years old. I said, you're absolutely right. So I got in the car and I went over the mountain and I picked up this kid and all her stuffed toys and animals and clothes. And it was in this big blue Oldsmobile, probably weighed 9,000 pounds. And I put her in the back seat of it. We didn't have car seats. We didn't use seat belts. I don't think it had seat belts, maybe. And I remember coming over the Highway 17 and through the Santa Cruz Mountains, and every time a car would come the other way, it would kind of light, the headlights would light up the back seat, and I would look in the rear view mirror, and I'd see this little blonde face back there like this, with all her toys and animals and things stuffed around her, and I was terrified. It's like, oh my God, I got a kid. I didn't know what to do with kids. I'm still in big bells and tank tops, man. I want you to see all my tattoos and what I used to look like. Cement man. Oh, concrete man, right? My wife keeps squeezing his arms. They used to squeeze mine. I'm just saying. Anyway. This is what you have to look forward to. I love you, man. Can't help it. And I got home and I don't know what happened. I was like in a sober blackout, I guess. I don't even remember going to bed, but I know that when I woke up the next morning, I thought I had had a kid dream. I really did. You know about the drinking dreams? My first thought was, oh my God, and then I realized it wasn't a dream. That I just so happened to have at that time a two-bedroom townhouse, which just so happened to be a half a block from a preschool, which just so happened to have one opening for a little girl. I was set up. And I got up and I walked across the bedroom and I opened my closet door, and there on the floor of my closet was her two little red tennis shoes that she had set in there the night before because she just wanted to belong somewhere. And I knew why those shoes were there. I was on the phone with her yesterday. I was in the back seat of David's car. Well, she's the only one that would talk to me or acknowledge me. These two were up front.
you know, squeezing his arm. But I was talking to my daughter, and I said, you know, I don't know if I'm going to do it or not. God does. But if I tell the little red tennis shoes story, I'm going to try not to cry this time. Why? Why would I try not to cry? It took me 30, 35 years to be able to. Why would I want to give that up? This program has given me so much. So much. When David called a long time ago, probably 9 months, and we're just talking, and then he said, well, I just wanted to know if you'd be able to speak at the convention this year. And I said, well, yeah, I can do that, but you need to know something. My sobriety date has changed. And I was able to tell him how it had changed. What I didn't tell you was that my wife found me on December 23rd in the morning, sitting in the middle of the kitchen floor with a bottle of her dinner wine. I thought I was still in bed. That allowed me to change my sobriety date for sure. I had been dabbling for quite a long time. Brain surgeries, you know, from motorcycle accidents, clean and sober. Leg surgeries and cables and rods and, oh, I have all these wonderful excuses. They just don't work anymore because I have you and you and you. You know? It's real easy in here to walk around and you get the pats on the back and the how you doing, you look so great, and oh, pretty motorcycle, and oh, that's a nice quad you ride, and oh, beautiful truck, and oh, that's nice. I appreciate all the compliments I get. However, the true things I really need here are the people that will stand in the gap for me and deliver the accountability when I need to have it. You know, it's true. It's true. Honey, you could lighten up on that one just a little, but I'm just saying, it's true. Wow. 20 years later and we still like each other. Mostly. She always says mostly. It is mostly. Because I have the ability to take my inventory, and she has the ability to take hers. We don't keep score, which keeps us out of judgment. Okay? And that's the truth. That's really the truth. So my daughter, she's now 40 years old. 10 or 11 years ago, David, she named her son after me. And I'm so grateful, man. You know why? Because that tells me I must have done okay raising her. But I got to tell you, I didn't do it alone. I did it with all of you. I would take her to meetings at night. I couldn't afford daycare and then babysitters at night. Plus, I wanted to be with her. I wanted my family. Like Opie was sharing last night. I'm going, wow. Because I got a little too busy at times. I was doing H&I work. I was doing all this other stuff. And I would go to meetings with her, and she'd have her jammies on with the little feet in them. And the ladies in Alcoholics Anonymous, oh, I love you for what you did for me and her. They sewed, they did things with her. She got to go to Nancy S.'s beach house frequently in Dillon Beach and, you know, all the stuff. I did not do it. We did. We raised this little girl. Speaking of H&I work, I got to start doing that a long time ago. And I'd go out to the James Boys Ranch and carry the message. And one day I'm at my men's meeting, and this guy walks up to me. His name's Kenny.
I believe he lives in Washington now with about close to 60 years sober. And he said, "Hey, David, you doing any H&I work?" And I said, "Yeah. Yeah, I'm going out to the boys' ranch." He says, I'm not talking about the boys' ranch. I'm talking about the county jail." I go, "Dude, they are not going to let me in the county jail." Apparently I had, and I counted them one time when I was in a holding cell. They left a folder in there. You never leave a folder with a prisoner. Come on, they're going to see what you got. And I had 51 arrests. Or I was arrested many times with 51 charges. I'm not sure. It doesn't matter now, does it? I just don't think I could do any more time, though, after having this. Kind of, "I love you, man." Go up and hug a guy on the second East Chow Hall. Oh, man, that might not go too well. So anyway, they said, "No, you need to start going to jail." I said, "Okay, Kenny, I'll give you a call." He said, "No, you won't." That's why Jim's out at his car right now getting you a clearance form out of his trunk. So I filled out the silly clearance form, and it said, "Have you ever been arrested or convicted?" I just put, "Will explain." I don't know. You must have a computer and a key on that computer that'll know more about me than I do. And about 2 weeks later, I'm sitting at the dinner table with my wife at that time, and my daughter, and my little boy. Met his mom in recovery 32 years ago. And the phone rang, and we had the voicemail answering machine, and I kind of had this thing about we don't answer the phone during dinner. It needed to be kind of family time. But I could hear the voice on the answering machine, and it said, "Hi, this is Yolanda Lopez. I am with the Department of Correction for Santa Clara County. I'm calling for David Searles. I just want you to know that your clearance has been approved." And I got to start going to jail. I went out to Elmwood to get fingerprinted. Like, they really need another set of my fingerprints out there. Man, come on, you guys. You're killing me. And when I walked in to do it, there she was. I'll never forget her. And she said, "You know, most of you guys from AA know how to do this fingerprinting better than me. Would you mind just running your own prints?" And I did. And I know where the squirty bottle was and the little paper towel. And I'm down. We're done. And then I'm walking out to the car, and I have this instant badge, Department of Correction. My name, my picture. And I'm thinking, man, if I ever get pulled over. First thought. And then I started crying. I just started crying. How do you go from point A to point B? How does this happen? It's the power greater than yourself. People in the room might be saying, "Oh, when am I going to have a spiritual experience?" If you're sitting here today and you be alcoholic and you're sober, you're having a spiritual experience. And if that guy that said, "Please, please, please don't keep secrets," I missed her whole act. If that guy's in the room, thank you. You planted a little seed, which came in the form of a grain of sand, which continued to grow bigger and bigger. David told me, "Your story needs to be told." And I feel like it certainly has. My life is full today. My mom was one of my amends I had a hard time with because of the brutality in my home. It's usually the other way around. I get that. But this case, it's not. Mom was the aggressor, and Mom did what she did. And I ended up just like her. For a long period of my life, I had to go to anger management. I spun the car out one time on Highway 680. I was so mad at 70 miles an hour, I just cranked the wheel. Sober! That was the wake-up call for me. Oh, my God, I need some outside help. And I got it. I got to do the healing the inner child stuff, and I got to do, you know, just a lot of different things. A guy named Bradshaw helped me at times. Mom was a school teacher. She was still tutoring when she was 82 years old. You know, Mom and Dad divorced after 37 years. Dad found his new wife. I call his angel. They were married for 30 years. And as Dad put it, they were on a 30-year honeymoon. You know, and he passed also. And I got to be with Mom when she passed. Deb and I were both there. And I got to be with Dad when he passed. And God and I were both there. And I started calling him Daddy after he had passed. And I'd never called him Daddy in my life. And I sat with him. They brought a chair in for me and pulled a curtain around us and just gave us some time to be together. That's what Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. You know? Opie said something last night that helped me as much as anything has helped me since I've been here. And he said these words, "I really didn't want to do this." And I'm going, "Oh, good, it's not just me. I really didn't want to do this." You know, this is maybe my third time at the podium in the last 4.5 years. And each time I make it very clear my sobriety date is no longer 9/13/83. Does anybody in here have a 9/13/83 birthday? Damn it. I could have been the only one. But then I wouldn't have the happiness, the joy, the freedom, the peace, the ability to love and to feel loved that I have today, that I've been given. You know. In closing,
I just want to say, I got nothing.
You play too, huh? Pippi Longstocking. Remember this one? Oh, yeah, I know. That wouldn't be you. Yeah. You have morals. There we go. There it is. I knew it was in there. And you know what? Where else could I end with that? Laughter. Keep laughing, folks. Keep doing what you're doing. You'll keep getting what you're getting. Thanks.
Mahalo, David. And now I have asked Bruce W. from the Big Island.